June 15th meeting of the House Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules to Order. I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3557.
Judith, will you tell us about this bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. House Bill 3557 requires surface mine reclamation plans to be approved by both the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries and the Department of Agriculture. It directs the DOGAMI to approve reclamation plans for sites containing at least 25% of Class 1 or Class 2 soils only if the site will be reclaimed to the same quality farmland that was present before the mining operation. It does define same quality farmland in the measure. It allows for concurrent reclamation if no more than 40 acres of land are unreclaimed at any one time. And finally, it requires a 100% bond for projected reclamation costs on land zoned for exclusive farm use, as if those farm use lands feature Class 1 or Class 2 soils. We're still waiting on fiscal and revenue statements on this measure, and I have provided for your easy reference. I just wanted to point out the OAR 660 sheet you have there. It gives the distinction between the counties. If you look at the bottom sub B there, it gives the distinction in aggregate classes of depth of deposit that determines whether or not a site is approved by the Department of Land Conservation and Development. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Judith. And we have a lot of people signed up. I had actually expected this much shorter witness list, so we are going to limit testimony to no more than 2 minutes apiece, and we will start with proponents, and then we will go to opponents. We have another bill that we are going to take up pretty close to 8:30, so please try to limit your testimony as much as you can. So first we'll call Roger Kane, Don Schellenberg, and Mark Reed.
Good morning. Good morning. Representative Rosenbaum, members of the committee. My name is Roger Kane. I currently reside at 10095 Parish Gap Road in Marin County, outside the city of Turner. I'm asking that you support House Bill 3557, which regards reclamation of prime farmland that has been mined for aggregate. I was unfortunate enough to become educated about aggregate mining, DOGAMI, and OCAPA in 1994 when the Marion County Commissioners proposed that our area, South Marion County, was a proposed aggregate overlay zone. Excuse me. We formed a group of Friends of Cloverdale and successfully quashed that proposal. After that, we were contacted by people all over Oregon who were experiencing problems with aggregate companies. We formed a statewide group called Oregonians for Responsible Planning. We saw thousands of acres of prime farmland authorized for aggregate mining and knew that the land would be lost forever. We learned that the aggregate industry was extremely powerful and that DOGAMI was so lax we couldn't even get an aggregate inventory of current vacated or approved mines. Oregon is losing thousands of acres of prime farmland every year, mainly to housing developments. This will only get worse due to Measure 37. We urge you to at least pass House Bill 3557 to help salvage the prime farmland we have left. It is bad enough that we allow aggregate mining on prime farmland. We should not. I hope you will at least consider this reclamation proposal. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you for your testimony. Please go ahead.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Don Schellenberg representing Oregon Farm Bureau. Just wanted to introduce Bruce Chapin with the Farm Bureau. He's chair of the Farm Bureau's Special Aggregate Committee. We've been working on this issue for a long time. You have in front of you a copy of the report that we commissioned, Eco Northwest did for us, and it discusses the issue of aggregate mining and what is the benefit to society of preserving our farmland. Again, we're not in opposition to mining. We don't want to keep losing our best farmland, and there's a way to do that, and that's what this bill is all about. I'll turn it over to Mr. Chapin. He has some extensive testimony. He can't give him 2 minutes. Would appreciate it if you would take the time to read his testimony in its entirety. It's very informative. Thank you, Madam Chair.
The committee members will certainly take a look at it. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm Bruce Chapin from Farm North of Salem, and Orchards and served as the chairman of the Oregon Farm Bureau Ag Committee. Also served in the government agriculture consensus process 2004 to 2007. Let me give you a little background to help explain why House Bill 3557 is before you today. There's been a major conflict between the two industries that's been growing for years. And the conflict between the two industries mainly occurs in the Willamette Valley, where based on the known tonnage used, we know that they're mining about 350 acres a year of farmland. This is based on some heavy calculations. It is not surprising that the problem is primarily located in the Willamette Valley when one remembers that the Willamette Valley is the only area in the state that Goal 5 permits the aggregate strip mining of our best farm soils. In the rest of Oregon, Goal 5 process does not permit aggregate mining on sites containing more than 35% Class 1 and 2 soils. When we entered into the consensus process in 2004, I was very optimistic the conflict between the two industries would be resolved and the two industries would be jointly bringing a solution to the 2005 legislative body. Both industries recognize the need to mine aggregate. The question is, where is the best interest in society should aggregate be mined? Aggregate mining is a necessary, destructive, and consumptive activity that needs to be located or will do the least damage. At the beginning of the consensus process, the aggregate industry expressed a willingness to limit mining on our best farm soils in exchange for an easier, more certain permitting process on poorer soils. This seemed to provide an easy, straightforward solution to the conflict. The entire group went to work trying to work out the details on an easy permitting process and protection of our best farm soils. As a deterrent to destroying our best farm soils, the aggregate industry suggested requiring better reclamation of aggregate mines. This is the same concept that's embodied in the bill you have before you. Optimism for success of the governor's consensus group continued to be high until the aggregate industry announced they no longer wanted an easy permitting process. They expressed concern that an easy permitting process would be detrimental to the existing aggregate businesses as it would reduce the value of the existing permitted mines. The aggregate industry's 180-degree change in position left the consensus group searching for an alternate approach that was never found.
Excuse me, Mr. Chapin.
Yes.
We do not have time for you to read your entire testimony.
Okay.
The committee members do have your written testimony.
Let me jump to the last page and just summarize it.
Thank you.
In fact, I'll in the last page, you see there are five things that are listed that what it does and does not do. Let me verbally add a sixth one. This does not in any way discourage deep pit mining. In order to reclaim a pit, it's going to take the same amount of rubble going into that pit as what came out. If you mine a truckload of rock out of a pit, you're going to put one truckload of rubble back in. It doesn't matter if you're going to mine 1,000 truckloads out of a pit, you're going to have to put 1,000 truckloads of rubble back in to reclaim it. And it doesn't matter whether it's a deep pit that's small diameter or whether it's a large diameter pit that's shallow. It's still going to be one truckload in for one truckload out. In no way does this in any way discourage deep pit mining. With that, I'll open up for questions.
Thank you. We'll hold questions till all of you have testified. Please go ahead.
My name is Mark Reed. I'm a geologist at the University of Oregon specializing in resource geology. I know I'm limited to 2 minutes. I'm going to cut to the quick. You have my written testimony in front of you. I would like to just make the point that that a substantial majority of the existing gravel pits and any expected gravel pits cut into Class 1 and 2 soils that were productive farmland before they were mined for gravel. And this is my key point. Speaking as a geologist, of all the places on the planet, the Willamette Valley is certainly one of the best places for supplying aggregate from quarries, basalt quarries, rather than the very best farmland. This is a place, the Willamette Valley, where we can really do that quite sensibly, and it's time that we essentially moved into the 21st century and started mining quarry rock for our aggregate demands instead of river rock. And that's really a key to preservation of the farmland. It's also very essential for our long-term good. Now, in my written testimony, as you'll see, I document the production figures, and one of the key points in the production information is that the Willamette Valley is already producing more than half of its aggregate from quarries, as opposed to sand and gravel. These quarries are in the hills, where the soils are low quality soils, not class 1 and 2, mostly class 5 or poorer, and some class 3 and 4. So mining quarry rock does not destroy farmland in the same way that mining sand and gravel does. Another key point you'll see on figure 3 in the testimony is a fundamental difference between quarry mining and sand and gravel mining. Sand and gravel mining is thin and wide. It takes a huge acreage at not much depth, whereas quarry mining goes down vertically. Quarry rock is thick and can be mined at great depth with a minimum of surface disturbance. And you'll see that in figures 3 and 4 in my testimony.
Mr. Reed, I'm sorry, but your time is up. If you could just wrap up.
Okay. I think the main point I would like to make to conclude is that other parts of the country are already taking 85% of their aggregate demand from quarries, not from sand and gravel and river bottoms, and it's time that Oregon did that also. And we certainly can. There's no question whatsoever that the resources out there that we can meet our demands with quarry rock instead of sand and gravel. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Members, we have a lot of other people signed up to testify. Are there any urgent questions that we need to ask of this panel? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. Next, we'll go to a panel of opponents, and I'll call Rich Angstrom, Bob Rindy. I have Gary Lynch, and then it says, if needed, in parentheses. And so if you can defer, we'll call Amy Joyce. And I assume you're Gary?
Yes.
Okay, so you do wish to testify.
I knew your time was valuable, so
okay.
I don't anything that can help the committee.
Please go ahead.
Who would you like to start?
Whoever you wish.
I guess I'll start and let you guys play cleanup. This is like old home week. My name's Rich Angstrom, and I'm the president of the Oregon Concrete and Aggregate Producers Association. You're seeing half the mediation group here already. We did spend 4 years working on it and got pretty close to a resolution. We do oppose the bill. We think that the interim work actually was very productive between the organizations and came to some agreements on some things and some things that we didn't agree on. We think that we need to continue talking as far as the two industries are concerned to try to resolve that, and that's really where this needs to go. It's hard to respond to all the things that were said in 2 minutes, and so I'm not able to do that. But what I will say is that I think this is about what Oregon's reclamation policy is. And the industry is supportive of reclaiming as much as we can back to farmland. But we have to balance that because we've got a pretty good an agreement with the environmental community on how we reclaim our pits back and make a good use of those pits for fish and wildlife habitat. And so there's a balance there that obviously has to play in. We do think also that as the bill addresses that there is a role for the Department of Ag as we do reclaim our mines back to farmland, that they assist the Department of Geology and Mineral Industries and our industry in finding ways of doing the best we can to get it back into productive agricultural lands. The one thing that was said that needs to be addressed is whether we oppose an easy process. We do oppose an easy process for all sorts of reasons. One is I don't think the land use community as a whole would accept that. But the other thing, it does create some problems with the industry. Bruce was right about that. But what we proposed in lieu of that is we need to shift the focus or create a path of least resistance to non-valuable farmland and or forest land, quarry land, and make the permitting process more streamlined and more certain for the members. And so basically you create a behavioral shift to the industry so they go to those paths of least resistance. And we think that's actually a good policy. We don't want to call it easy because you still got to get all the federal permits, all the state permits, all the local government permits, and that's going to be anything but easy. So there are some good things that came out of that, and there is places to move. And in conclusion, we oppose the bill for a variety of reasons. But we think that sitting down with the agricultural community and the state agencies and the local governments that are involved in this process and continue pushing forward.
Rich, could you wrap up?
Yeah, this process only was interrupted because of the legislative changes in the legislative process. I think we'd still be talking otherwise. So that concludes. my testimony.
Thank you.
Vice Chair, members of the committee, I'm Bob Rindy with the Department of Land Conservation and Development, and I understand that our rules are at issue today, and that's part of why I signed up to thinking at the end, thinking there might be questions on our rules, which I think you your administrator has handed out to you. In 1995, under Governor Kitzhaber, his assistant Greg Wolf sponsored a mediation session that included OCAPA and Farm Bureau, and I was included in those meetings as well. And we ultimately reached agreement that are reflected in the rules that Ms. Callens has handed out to you, OAR 660-023-0180. And to cut to the chase on those rules, there was an agreement at that time that our policy, DLCD's policy on directing local governments in evaluating and making decisions on whether to allow aggregate mining on farmland was going to be a policy that, first of all, tried to encourage that on lower quality farmlands, which these rules have that effect of doing by prohibiting mining on certain when sites are comprised of a certain percentage, 35% of class 1 or 2 soils. But does allow mining of those soils if we are, if the local government is authorizing very deep sites. And the idea of the rules allowing mining on the better soils only if the aggregate mining is very deep is that you're only authorized, in other words, to dig up farmland if you're going to get a lot of aggregate per acre. So very deep sites are high amount of quality or quantity of rock with the minimum disturbance of the surface. I'm afraid that what this bill does is it will work against that policy because, indeed, probably the sites that you will be able to mine and reclaim in the manner that this bill provides would be sites that are shallow. In other words, the deep sites that are authorized and are encouraged under our rules wouldn't be practical, and indeed you're going to disturb a great deal more farmland by shallow mining, but therefore allowing the industry over time to reclaim that, but it's going to be for many of the sites many, many years before that is reclaimed, and I think that does work against the current policy. So we do have some concerns with this. We are part of the work group. We know this was on the table last year as one element of a bigger agreement between farmers and aggregate mining interests, and we were sorry to see those talks break down. I think it was because of the pending legislative session. We'd like to see those talks get started again, and I think adopting something that's sort of one side proposal of this is going to work against that.
I'll wrap up. Are there any questions for this panel?
Well, we haven't heard from the
panel. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay.
Excuse me, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Gary Lynch, and Assistant Director of the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. I would just simply start with where we've been, and there are very reasonable people with strong opinions on both sides of this issue. We respect everything everybody says, but at bottom line, it's a very difficult issue, and Oregon needs both a healthy agriculture industry and a healthy aggregate industry that can provide a long-term affordable supply of aggregate, and the reason that's important is if we want our roads to be continually maintained and built up and provide the infrastructure necessary, then we need a healthy aggregate industry, and transportation is a critical factor. So when I say that, the further you haul aggregate, if it's from the forest uplands, the price of aggregate goes up and the number of roads ODOT bills goes down, or there's some other revenue change. That said, I believe the answer is in the interim. And that's why we oppose this bill. We think we need to have this discussion start up again. We need leadership from the legislature and the governor's office, as well as the agencies and the interest groups. From my perspective, I haven't seen this issue become this visible in my 20 years here. And I think that's a healthy thing. I think that will lead to the resolutions we need. That said, reclamation to us is the answer. And how we get there, Granted, there are differences on both sides, but I think there is some middle ground. The land can be reclaimed. That said, I think, again, talking with legislators on this issue and talking with the governor's office, this has the most visibility I've seen in my 20 years, and I suggest any support we can get for an interim solution is the real answer, not this bill that we have in front of us today. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Okay, thank you very much. Next, we'll call Kate Kimball, Marky Easley, and Kathleen Carl. People are sending me notes that they want to be added to this list. We can't take any more testimony. In fact, we're going to be hard-pressed to get through the witnesses that we have signed up. I assure you, if this bill gets scheduled for another hearing, we will allow additional public testimony. So you have 2 minutes each. Please go ahead.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. My name is Kate Kimball, and I'm staff attorney at 1000 Friends of Oregon for this issue, and I have 3 points, which I hope will not take 2 minutes. First is, I know you're all busy, this is really about the best soils. When you think of Class 1 and Class 2 soils, you're thinking delta loam, the soft, the really rich soils that can produce almost any kind of crop, and that's really important from the agriculture industry's point of view, because that flexibility means that we can keep adjusting to international issues about what kind of crops are popular and that sort of thing. Secondly, 1000 Friends was part of the consensus process, and I will just say this as a personal observation in over 25 years of negotiating and public policy, it is really hard to negotiate when one side is focused and in agreement and the other side is made up of very different, similar but different interests. And this is not to cast aspersions on the aggregate industry, but they are large and small producers. Some are very dependent on alluvial soil, some are more dependent on quarry. And any shift in the status quo shifts the market advantage for some of their members. And it's difficult. It is not impossible. So I guess my point is that if we restart this process, we need to take that into account and think of a process that takes those kind of just factors into consideration. And again, it's not to cast aspersions, it's just to notice what is. My third point is Echo Northwest did a study for the Farm Bureau in which they concluded that a complete ban on mining on Class 1 and 2 soils, they concluded, we find the dire predictions about the effects of such a policy, that is a ban, on the aggregate industry simply do not withstand scrutiny. The bill before you does not do such a ban, even though Echo Northwest found that it could. What it says is, on our very best soils, let's reclaim them a little bit better because they are very best soils. Thank you for your time.
Please go ahead.
My name is Kathleen Carl. I'm part of a farm family from Hubbard, Oregon, and I'm interested in preserving farmland, particularly in the Willamette Valley. And when you look at farmland in the valley, adjacent land is very important, and as much as possible, I'd like to reduce the risk from adjacent land. So I think that reclaiming this high-value farmland would help to preserve farmland in the valley. And also, I think the ma'am stated about transportation. As I understand, it's not that far to quarry in the hills. It's not like a huge transportation issue. So I think that reclaiming our high-value farmland to protect the farms that are next to it is a good step. And I support this.
Thank you for your testimony. Please go ahead.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Marge Easley. I'm president of the League of Women Voters of Oregon, which is a grassroots nonpartisan political organization that encourages informed and active participation in government. The League also participated in the lengthy aggregate farmland consensus group, and we followed this issue for some time. We're here today to express our support for HB 3557, which we feel offers some important statutory amendments dealing with surface mining reclamation plans. The League believes this bill is an excellent first step in preventing the destruction of some of Oregon's best farmland. And we urge you to carefully consider the long-term benefits of instituting clear reclamation requirements for the mining industry. We base this testimony on some strong land use positions that the League has that support management of land as a finite resource, not as a commodity. We feel that land ownership carries responsibility for stewardship. We believe in regulation of areas of critical concern, including significant agricultural land. And we feel that reclamation of lands damaged by surface mining is critically important. Reclamation has long been promoted as an effective tool. However, productivity is a relative term, and in the case of prime unique in Class 1 and 2 soils, we feel that the true productivity of this land is not recognized as critically important. So once these agricultural lands are gone, they're gone forever. And so we feel that the 25% is an appropriate standard for reclamation. We urge you to pass this bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Okay, thank you very much. We have one more opponent, Amy Joyce, and then proponents Jim Gilbert, Sam Sweeney, and Fran Taylor. So why don't you all come up together? Amy, do you want to go ahead, please?
Thank you, Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee. Amy Joyce, Department of Transportation. And with respect, Chair, I believe I signed up as neutral. If I didn't,
I'm sorry.
I want to make clear the department is neutral on the bill. Handed in some
written. Yes, you did. You're right.
Okay. Handed in some written testimony. The department relies on aggregate to build and maintain roads. I think our 2001 number is about 8 million tons of aggregate per year. We believe that the anticipated result of HB 3557 would be that we would be hauling aggregate and requiring our private suppliers to haul aggregate further than they would without the bill, because as existing aggregate mines are exhausted, it will be much more difficult to get the permits in the valley, and those mines then will be further and further away. And the cost for truck hauling of aggregate is about 20 cents per ton per mile. So with the math at 8 million tons a year, that's a lot of money. We would anticipate that over time you'd be talking about probably millions of dollars per year in additional costs to the highway fund. So that's the concern of the department. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Please go ahead.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, I'm Jim Gilbert. I live in Malala, Oregon. I'm chair of the Malala Community Planning Organization and also a full-time farmer. The Malala Community Planning Organization represents over 1,000 people who live in the rural areas surrounding the city of Malala, and our role is to give these citizens a voice in land use and other issues affecting them. The CPO has consistently spoken in favor of protecting farmland in our region and in Oregon, and we are currently attempting to stop a gravel mine project that would result in a 50-foot deep hole in over 100 acres of prime farmland, taking this land out of production forever. This mine is located in a rural area surrounded by berry farms, poultry farms, and many homes. Protecting our prime farmland is essential for the future of our state. Many of you have heard the news about the contamination of imported animal feed. Protecting our farmland and growing our food locally not only supports our farmers, it's a matter of food security for our state. Protecting farmland is also important for our state's economy. It protects wildlife and the environment and allows for the potential of growing biofuel crops in the future. The American Farmland Trust rates the Willamette Valley as one of the most endangered regions in America regarding potential loss of farmland. We have some of the best soils in the country and a climate that permits the growing of a wide range of crops. Yet development pressure is great, and defending our farmland takes constant vigilance. Just as there are many areas to build houses that will not take our best soils out of production, there are many areas to mine gravel that will not impact our prime farmland. The Malala CPO requests that you pass HB 3557 and require that if gravel is mined on prime farmland, that the site be returned to farmable condition.
Thank you. Hey, thank you. My name is Fran Taylor. I reside in Malala, Oregon. And I'm here to encourage your support of House Bill 3557. There is a proposed gravel mine in my area, and it's the same gravel mine which Jim spoke. I thought that I was the poster child, and this gravel mine was the poster child for loss of farmland, but I find it's only one of many poster childs. That this permanent loss of farmland is so widespread in our valley. It's not just a little problem. It's a big problem. The area I live is very idyllic with grazing land, berry farms, poultry farms, and if the proposed gravel mine in my area is passed, those small farms will now have to compete with aggregate mining for their very lives, for their livelihood. And at the end of the proposed period, 15 years plus of aggregate mining, the loss of the farmland will be permanent, and we will be left with an 80-plus acre hole in the ground filled with water. So again, I urge your support of House Bill 3557. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for these witnesses? Vice Chair Buckley.
Madam Chair, thank you. I'll try to be very brief. But, Mr. Richard, maybe you could help me on this, depending on the cost of the mining. And I just think I'd give you a chance if you would respond to what Mr. Gilbert's talking about in terms of restoring farmland. Did that factor into your evaluation of what costs would be if we're talking about companies having to go farther to get the rock or actually putting back in rubble to restore farmland? Did you make an analysis of that in terms of what the cost difference is?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Buckley, I believe our aggregates experts' perspective is that it's effectively not very likely that such a reclamation plan could happen, that it could be done in a cost-effective manner. So I guess my answer is that cost prohibitive to reclaim to the degree described in the bill. So the only answer then is to go further away. It would be more expensive to reclaim the land for a closer by gravel operation.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would love at some point, though, to get any information you would have on what the cost to do the reclamation would be.
I'll work on that.
Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. And we have one more witness, Sam Sweeney. Please come forward.
Madam Chair, committee members, my name is Sam Sweeney. I live and farm in 1070 Dayton, Oregon. We have some farmland down in the river bottoms close to the Willamette River. I strongly urge you to pass Senate House Bill 3557. There are many reasons why, and I'm only going to focus on three. I know time is short. Number one, the loss to Oregon's economy and farm communities of prime class one and two soils. Some of these soils that they're mining, Newberg series, there's only 1,620 acres in Yamhill County. That's all we have. Once that's gone, it's gone. They're very productive soils. Our family has experienced really great yields down there, at least 5 to 10% higher than the upland soils. The next point I'd like to focus on, the reason that you should pass Senate Bill or House Bill 3557, is the conversion of ag land to mineral extraction weakens the integrity of the Willamette Valley's river systems. And they dig these deep pits close to the river, and you have these floods that periodically go through 64, 74, and 96. Creates a lot of erosion. And 96 in particular, we had some really huge losses of soil. And so it's not hard to imagine that when you got these deep pits that you're going to have head cutting and lots of erosion. And it takes major amounts of money to kind of, put in structures that's going to withstand those kind of floods. The third reason is the mining industry under this bill can restore their mining sites or explore other options to meet their needs. Most of the miners that I've talked to or have knowledge of, they've been buying up a lot of this ag land. We in agriculture cannot compete against what they're willing to pay for this land. One time period, 11-month time period, there were 750 acres converted from ag to mineral extraction. Just in a short river section. Grand Island, which is where the vegetable industry started in Oregon, 3,300 acre island. Right now there's permits on that island for 13%, and it's rumored very strongly that there's another 240 acres that's going to come online. It's not that we're against the gravel industry. We think they have other options. There's quarry rock. There's rock on the Columbia River. And we've heard some talk about, well, you can't truck it very far, but you can barge it down, and we've got figures that show that you can barge this rock down the Portland metro area for $2.80 a ton. Now, that's a whole lot cheaper than shipping it from Yamhill County to the Portland metro area, and I think that's one of the things that they ought to focus on. So, in summary, We really don't have a lot of time. I mean, they're just a lot of these gravel companies are moving on this ag land. Ag just cannot compete, and so it's absolutely essential that we do something to preserve our class one and class two soils that ag depends on. We have no other option. We can't go anywhere else. So, in summary, I strongly urge you to consider this House Bill 3557. Thank you very much.
North Shales.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for Mr. Sweeney?
I have a comment, though, before
yes.
we close.
Okay.
No questions.
No questions. Thank you for being here. Yes, Representative Breslin.
Yeah, I do have a question. We had a number of these bills in Ag and Natural Resources this last session, and it is the number one issue from all of our members that needs to be dealt with in the interim. It's on the list of things that are going to the speaker to say that we need to have this discussion during the interim. I think it is very important. Today you heard one aspect, and that's the mining of it. There's also aspects of how do you take it out of rivers and how do you do other kinds of things. And so more and more of these discussions, and one group doesn't like this and does like this, and it's alike. Right-to-farm issues that we have, I think that the ag group has, and that, you know, we get so many different people having these impacts that every one of them sounds reasonable, but it's going to take a bigger discussion where you have all the people in the room to make sure that things happen in appropriate ways and we figure out how do we do these things, in my opinion. And I really appreciate this hearing because I think that it's important to get those things out and to let people know. I really was impressed with Don Schoenbart's comments about, and others, the Dagami and other people saying, I haven't seen so much interest in this issue. I think it's true. If you go back and look at Measure 37, a bunch of these claims are Measure 37 claims, and so it all goes together in our land use planning, and how do we make sure that we have things available for things like roads, because every agriculture person out here wants to be able to get their product to market, so they want roads, so they're not trying to be against that, but how do we make it work? And I think it's going to take a big discussion. I know all the people on our Ag Committee felt very strongly that this was maybe one of the number one issues, but we didn't have time to figure out which one of these was going to be the right answer. And so, just so you know, regardless of how we move this bill or not, this will be an issue in the interim with respect to Ag.
Yeah, I would like to just second those comments. I think clearly by the number of people that showed up to testify today in support of the bill, there is a real problem that needs to be addressed, and that we have certainly gone a long way to at least starting that discussion. So I want to thank everybody for being here. And that completes our sign-up sheet. I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3557, and I'll open a public hearing on Senate Bill 443A. And we'll turn to administrators and Senator Deckard, if you'd like to come forward to tell us about this bill. And Mr. Stembridge, could you please tell us what we're looking at?
Madam Chair, Senate Bill 443A sets conditions and process for establishing public corporation to negotiate for purchase of an investor-owned utility if the purchase is proposed. On the summary, you'll see additional provisions of the measure. You have the -A13 amendment from Senator Deckard declares state policy that Oregon Community Power, that's the name of the corporation that would do the purchasing if the purchase would go through under this bill. Oregon Community Power would have full rights to the lowest cost electric generated by the Bonneville Power Administration. It deletes provisions declaring policy on rights to and distribution of federal electric power and other rights and benefits of consumer-owned utilities.
Okay. Thank you for that explanation. Good morning, Senator Deckard.
Good morning, Madam Chair. It smells bad in here.
Yes. Yeah,
thank you.
It's not us.
It was yesterday,
I'm
too.
Far enough away. No, it's not
here
you.
Yeah. Have you reported?
Yes. Would you like the story?
It's on there. That's
yeah,
on the record.
We have a brief story on this. We understand that there was a vomit-like smell up and down here, and they've worked on that. I would say the smell is not vomit-like today. It smells like something different today, but the facilities people are working on it. Those of you who are outside of the Capitol, I guess you can consider yourselves lucky.
Okay, thank you. Please go ahead, Senator Deckard, and I apologize for the conditions.
I'm trying to think of a funny, like, this bill doesn't smell. Not very witty.
Bill is a breath of fresh air.
It's better. It's better. Well, I'm Ryan Deckard, state senator from Washington County. Madam Chair, I could go on at great length in terms of the passion I have and the strong feelings and the work that has gone on over the last 2 to 3 years, really looking at and just to be brief on this, what was a really disorganized process that we saw a few years ago when we had the sell of Enron from PGE or from Enron back to the good situation we find ourselves in today, which is the standalone company PGE, but really dealing with what happens when we have an ownership situation like we experienced a few years ago of one of our IOUs, and having some thoughtful, rational process in place for customers, because what we saw a few years ago was a very disorganized process and not one that I think lent itself for customers or actually for one of our fine utilities in the state, PGE. So that is where we came up with Senate Bill 443, and I would thank Representative Berger for her assistance through the years. It really is just the framework carefully negotiated with our utilities, with the customer groups, ICNU, CUB, and to some extent AOI, a thoughtful, rational process that you would put in place if we do find ourselves in a situation that customers would want to make a bid that the board could take a look at of one of the IOU utilities, take a look at for the utility. And so that is what you see before you in Senate Bill 443. The chief arguments that I would make is really two. One is, why wouldn't you? I think we are lacking as a state for a thought-out state statute. This is what you have before you. And secondly, with the repeal of PUCA, which is the Depression Era law from the federal government that really restricted utility ownership, and that was repealed about a year and a half ago at the federal level, it really widened the field for utility ownership. Thankfully, in Oregon, we don't have a situation, but if you look across the country, just in the last couple of years, you see you are replete with examples of great, great acquisitions and acquisitions that at least as customers, we all have to at least take a deep breath and think, is this going to be in the best interest of our businesses and our residents throughout the state? With the repeal of PUCA and the broadening of ownership, I think it is just so, so critical that states at least have something on the books that has buy-in from the utilities, from the customer groups, from the counties and the cities and all the folks that would be involved in it, of how citizens would come together, ratepayers, both residential and business ratepayers, and have a thoughtful conversation about the acquisition of the utility. Madam Chair, that is the bill. I think it is one that too many hours of lawyer time from all angles have been spent hammering out the details, and I think it's one that is important that the state get on the books. Thank
and
you.
Did you want to comment on the Dash A13 amendment?
I believe CUB, the Citizens Utility Board, okay, and I'm going to try to stick around. But that deals with...
Do they have it? What about the board? Oh, yeah.
Let me mention the board.
Yeah, there is also a Dash 13. Okay, so we'll let you, if you need to come back and talk about that after they do, available.
I'm happy to. I'll stick around.
And Mr. Stembridge,
Madam Chair, I did want to mention the Dash 14, which is simply a conflict amendment. It resolves conflicts with Senate Bill 838C, which has been signed by the governor this week.
And that was the renewable
energy standard. Actually, it was signed last
week, June 6th.
Yes.
14. Okay. Thank you. Any questions for Senator Deckard? Okay, thank you for your testimony. Next, we'll call Jeff Bissonnette.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Bissonnette, representing the Citizens Utility Board. We are named in state statute as the representative of residential ratepayers of regulated utilities working on issues related to electric, natural gas, and telecommunications utilities. Here today to support Senate Bill 443. utility ratepayers have options if they are, if somehow they want to change their utility service or their utility structure. There's a law in the books for them to create a people's utility district to kind of carve out a section of their existing utility and become a public utility or consumer-owned utility. If a municipality wants to create a utility to serve its residents, there is a law to create a municipal electric utility. There are laws on the books governing the private non-profit corporations known as electric co-ops. But what we realized in dealing with some of the issues around Portland General Electric and its history to try and get out from the end of the shadow of Enron was there was no way to really kind of move as a utility the size of PGE into public ownership if that's what ratepayers and the municipalities within that service territory wanted. And also we experienced a situation where there was a proposed buyer, Texas Pacific Group, for the utility that we came to believe would not be in the interest of ratepayers for that purchase to go through. In fact, it would have been to the great detriment of ratepayers. Fortunately, the Public Utility Commission agreed with us, and that sale did not go through, and we're in a much better situation now. But what Senate Bill 443 does is a couple of things. One, as Senator Decker pointed out, is sets up a rational system to kind of look at these issues with a utility that does not fit or with a utility situation that does not fit within the PUD formation law, within the municipality utility formation law, or within the formation of a co-op or electric co-op. Really kind of tries to deal with the situation that we saw with PGE, but we might see again with some other similarly sized utility. And so we are here in support of establishing that that process and that statute in the books, sort of as a value to consumers, to make sure that if there is a proposed sale of utility and that is the only thing that can trigger the formation of Oregon Community Powers, if the utility has already accepted a proposed sale and has started that review process over the PUC, then the municipalities within the service territory can then trigger a review process to see if the municipalities in that service territory want to form an initial review committee involving customers and make an effort in front of the Public Utility Commission to see if they want to buy the utility and bring it into public hands. I come today also offering the A13 amendments, and I distributed a brief memo to members of the committee yesterday afternoon. And currently the way the bill is written is, says that the customers, the residential customers of the new Oregon Community Power would receive the same benefits from the federal hydro system administered by the Bonneville Power Administration equal to whatever the benefits the incumbent utility or the customers of the incumbent utility are getting at the time that Oregon Community Power would be formed. We have witnessed in the past few weeks sort of an underscoring of how uncertain that situation is. As I said in my memo that I distributed yesterday, if this bill had been in effect and Oregon Community Power would have been formed a month ago, we would have been receiving the level of, through the residential exchange, or the level of benefits offered by that residential exchange that were in place at that time. Today, if Oregon Community Powers was formed, residential customers would have no right to any benefits from the Bonneville Power Administration, and that is something that's troubling to us. In federal law, there is no distinction made between types of utilities and who is has a right to these benefits and access to these benefits. And so we believe that since federal law doesn't make that distinction, state law shouldn't either. So we brought forth this fairly straightforward amendment, just making clear that it would be the policy of the state that Oregon Community Power, should it come into existence, would have the right of any other public utility that would be formed in the state of Oregon. That said, if the committee would choose not to to improve the bill by adopting this amendment, the bill is still a very good bill and would deserve to move forward. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Yes, Vice Chair Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm very supportive of Senate Bill 443. My city of Ashland has tremendous concern with the amendment. However, they're concerned there's not any consequence that a municipal utility like Ashland will suffer and not be able to have access to BPA power if we pass this amendment. Comment?
Madam Chair, Representative Buckley, that is definitely a concern. However, there are two ways to access the benefits of the Bonneville system. One that has been open to the customers of investor-owned utility is sort of through the side door of the residential exchange. The other way is through the front door of forming a public. And so if, as we have argued about the residential exchange over the years, the answer to the customers of investor-owned utilities have been, well, form a public, and then then the discussion will be over. And so what we're saying is that if a public is formed, under this bill, it should not have the distinction, and that will certainly create issues within the Bonneville system, but that's an issue of federal law. And so, again, because federal law doesn't make the distinction, we don't think state law should either. But it would certainly kick off another round of conversations that would be and I'm not sure what the end point of that discussion is. But again, we don't see really a policy reason to to deny the customers of an incumbent IOU the ability to access benefits that are allocated under federal law if they form a public.
Thank you for your answer. I'm going to have to oppose the amendment. Thank you.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I have a similar one. We have some PUDs in our area that have a lot of angst over the amendment. No real problem with the bill. And so the structure, I think, is an important thing to get there. And I am also one of those people that they see the same concern as Ashland does, but in a slightly different way because of their arrangement. So I would be opposed to the amendment.
Other questions for this witness? Okay, thank you very much for your testimony. Next, we'll call Tom O'Connor, Sandy Flicker, and Don Goddard.
You made the motion. But I do like that. You got a good reputation, so don't blow it now.
Good morning. Please go ahead.
Good morning, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Sandy Flicker, representing the Oregon Rural Electric Co-op Association. And I'm going to let my mate here, Tom O'Connor, kick our testimony out.
Excuse me, for the record, Tom O'Connor with Oregon Municipal Electric Utility Association. Madam Chair, members of the committee, we're here to testify about the amendment. The underlying bill, at least Oregon Municipal Electric Utilities, has no problem with the underlying bill, and it does not. It sets up, as was discussed, a process for a unique circumstance with this very large utility like PGE or Pacific. It doesn't change any of the existing statutes as far as forming municipal utilities on a smaller level. So we have no problem with the underlying bill. We are opposed to the amendment. The existing language as it came over from the Senate creates an important balance, given that what's at issue here is such a very large utility. The existing language talks about providing benefits to the new utility that would be the same, at least the same as the incumbent utility. And at the same time, however, it says that the formation of this very large utility, the policy would be that it not harm the existing public power utilities in terms of rates or benefits. So we would favor the existing language as it came over the Senate. I'd just like to clarify one point, maybe 2 points that Mr. Bissonnette said about the existing situation with the residential exchange. There has been a federal court decision that the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals invalidated the procedures that Bonneville has used in the past to determine the level of the residential exchange. As a result of that, Bonneville has halted the current payments. However, I think it's important to understand the statement was made that this new entity would have no right to benefits. That's not true. What's at issue in the court decision and is the level of benefits. Public power is supportive of we recognize that the residential exchange benefits are part of the regional act. The customers, the small farm customers of the and residential customers of the IOUs are entitled to those benefits. We don't quarrel with that. There is a dispute over the amount. Secondly, and you'll see from the letters that I've handed out, there is a process underway at the regional level right now where the private utilities in the region, the public utilities in the region, are sitting down at the negotiating table to come up with a recommendation back to Bonneville for a way to go forward from here in light of the court decision. That process is underway. There will be a solution. There has to be a solution shortly because all of our contracts are shortly up for renewal. So with that, I'll and then answer any questions.
And your comment, you referred to the amendment that I assume you're talking about the Dash 13 amendment and the Dash 14 you have no problem with?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, again, my name is Sandy Flicker, and I'm here representing the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association, and here also in opposition to the Dash 13 amendments to Senate Bill 443, and would agree with Mr. O'Connor that we have no position on Senate Bill 443 unamended. However, we also have no problem with the Dash 14s. Sandy, if you just conflict amendments. I have not a lot more to add to what Mr. O'Connor said, except that I did want to just address the issue of state policy. We do seem to believe that the legislature does have a role in determining state policy, and particularly a state policy that takes into consideration all the electricity customers in the state. So the language that is currently in Senate Bill 443, we believe, does that. It does create a fair and balanced approach. It does look at potential impact on other electricity customers in the state should we form a new large public. There are 18 electric cooperatives in Oregon, and we serve only 10% of the state and 65% of the state geographically. We have a very, very low density, and our only power supply source is Bonneville. We're 100% customers from Bonneville. This is an important issue for us. We certainly would never, ever, ever oppose benefits to all customers in the state from Bonneville, but clearly the issue of our power supply and how we are impacted by state decisions is very important to the small rural electric co-ops in Oregon. So we do believe that the current version takes that into consideration, and we would like those fair and balanced provisions in that bill to remain. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And I see Representative Edwards in the room. Representative, we have two more witnesses on the bill that we're on now. Are you able to stay with us until we get through this?
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you. Please go ahead.
Madam Chairman, I'm Don Goddard from the Oregon Public Utility Districts Association. We're here to oppose the amendment 13, the Dash 13 amendments. We supported Portland's City of Portland's purchase of the PG assets and worked with the surrounding communities to help them understand how their interests could be addressed. And one of the big problems we were faced with was uncertainty about how much power, how much benefits they could get from the federal system. Senate Bill 443, Section 27 answers those questions and would make the process workable, and so we think that's a good bill. The Dash 13 amendments would undo that, restore a great deal of uncertainty, and make the underlying purpose of the bill more difficult to achieve. So we oppose the Dash 13 amendments. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions for these witnesses? Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you.
We have one more witness on this bill, and that is Mark Nelson. If you'd please come forward. Good morning.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mark Nelson, representing industrial customers of Northwest Utilities. 2 years ago, Texas Pacific Group proposed to purchase PGE. ICNU strongly opposed that acquisition at that time. We also opposed a mutual utility concept that was proposed by some Lake Oswego investors at that time. We did support Senator Deckert and Representative Berger's Oregon Community Power Act. PGE is a very attractive utility for acquisition. We're not encouraging that acquisition, but we do know that, in fact, there are potential people out there who would look at PGE for acquisition. We think all customers, residential, commercial, and industrial, need options. In terms of the Texas Pacific Group, all customer groups were strongly in opposition to that particular purchase. The PUC, however, did provide the protection and provided a responsible response to that acquisition, and they should be congratulated for that. Senate Bill 443, I think, provides, again, another that same kind of option. This bill has been tweaked and tweaked, and I think it is an even better product than it was 2 years ago. We need to have this option in place rather than wait for another purchaser such as TPG and then have to respond back to that. So we support passage of 443. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any questions? Okay. Thanks for your testimony. And that completes our sign-up sheet. I will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 443 and open a work session on Senate Bill 443A. Yes, Vice Chair Berger.
Madam Chair, I think that in light of the testimony, I will bypass the Dash 13 amendments and move adoption of the Dash 14 amendments.
Representative Berger moves the Dash 14 amendments to Senate Bill 443. Is there discussion? Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. And Representative Berger.
Madam Chair, I move Senate Bill 443 as amended with the Dash 14s to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
And Representative Berger moves Senate Bill 443A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion?
Can I make one comment?
Yes, Representative Berger.
I appreciate Cubs bringing forward the amendment. I understand their issue, but I think at this time it would not be a friendly amendment to a bill that has been worked on very hard for two sessions now, and it allows us an important framework. The bill itself, I think, should be well supported. The state of the federal power is in flux. I would encourage us to move forward with this bill now, get it on the books, and we will continue to deal with the Bonneville Power issue.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. Not realizing you're going to be moving this today, I don't feel like I have a good grasp of this bill yet, and I feel uncomfortable just making a rash decision and saying, oh, yeah, I would like to support it if I understand it better, and I would like to reserve my yes for later.
Okay, thank you.
Okay.
And Representative Roblin.
I just want to say I appreciate Representative Berger's comments and the fact that she is flux, as in flux capacitor. That was part of Back to the Future. And being an electrical bill, I think this is a good thing.
Oh, my God. Give that man a chocolate.
The candy's cooking in there.
Thank you. And I would just say that I think clearly the support is not there for the Dash 13 amendments, but I think they do raise an extremely important issue, and that is that we are at a crisis point with the issue over BPA power, and residential customers are now suffering whopping increases on their electric bills, and we need a solution to that. And so, you know, it's not going to happen in this bill. Clearly, we also need to move forward on that. And I see no further discussion, so Shauna, please call the roll.
Aye.
Aye. No.
Aye.
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 Excused. Aye. Motion carries. And Representative Berger, since you are the chief co-sponsor, would you like to carry this on?
I would very much like to explain it to my colleagues on the floor and in this room.
Thank you, Representative Berger. And I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 443. And I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 3562. And Judith. Welcome back. Please tell us about this bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members. House Bill 3562 replaces forest or rangeland woody debris with the current statutory definition for woody biomass with respect to the types of biomass energy that may be used to meet the 2025 renewable portfolio standard. I have provided that current definition in the second paragraph of the background. We have received a no revenue, still waiting to hear from fiscal on the 3562. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And Representative Chris Edwards, I see that you are here to talk about this bill, so please come forward. And we do have quite a lengthy sign-up sheet of people to testify on this bill as well. We do not have a lot of time to devote to it, so we will try to get through as many witnesses as possible. And Representative Edwards, please go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Representative Chris Edwards, representing House District 14, West Eugene, Santa Clara, Junction City, Cheshire, and Alvador. For the record, I am not Representative Ben Cannon, although I've been called that at least twice today and been congratulated five or six times in the last couple of days.
I'm sure your wife may be concerned to know that.
Thank you for hearing this bill. I think that this debate about the definition of woody biomass as it relates to renewable energy is not new this session, and we heard a lot about it in the debate over Senate Bill 838. But I would contend that we actually didn't hear enough about it, and it's my contention that that definition got caught up in the politics of a much larger historic policy decision. And already this legislature, the 74th legislature, has taken a historic step in passage of Senate Bill 838, the renewable energy bill. And that was a bill that I was very much supportive of for all sorts of reasons. But as much as I supported that bill, I don't think that it was without its deficiencies, and especially with regard to the definition of biomass. Now, when I got to looking into this issue, I went to ORS 526.277, which I have distributed a copy to you about. And since I wasn't here last legislative session, I started digging into, well, how did ORS 526.277 come about? Well, it came about through Senate Bill 1072 last session, which was a bill specifically to address forest policy, much of which was the definition of biomass for the purposes of creating renewable energy. I mean, that was the definition of biomass was a big part of that bill. And I would like to point out that bill passed 56 to, I think it was 56 in favor, 1 opposed, and 3 excused. Including, I would like to be corrected if I am mistaken, that I believe every member of this committee voted for that bill last, and that was the essence of the bill. And so I would like to point out that in the definition in 526.277, that's ORS 526.277, woody biomass means material from trees, woody plants, including limbs, tops, needles, leaves, and other woody parts grown in a forest, woodland, farm, rangeland, or wildland-urban interface environment that is the byproduct of forest management, ecosystem restoration, or hazardous fuel reduction treatment. Also, as a part of that bill, is a whole list of policy statements about why using biomass to create renewable energy is a good thing to do. So in my view, and it's probably not the view of everybody, but I'm still kind of at a loss for why this definition was not included in Senate Bill 838. I mean, the way I see the world, this is a housekeeping bill. You know, and I mean, I really do not understand why we would have a well-vetted issue last session, which I was not a part of, but it was well-vetted. It passed the Senate, came to the House. There was disagreement between the House and the Senate about what that bill should look like. They finally worked it all out, and it passed. So, and I believe that this is a problem that warrants addressing, because if I were an investor or a bank involved in a woody biomass renewable energy project, I would be very hesitant to invest if there's not clarity about whether or not my renewable energy project is going to count as a renewable energy project. And so without that clarity, I mean, what prudent investor would move forward with such a project? So, you know, while I wasn't here last session, in my investigation about into how this came to be, it appears to me that this is good policy, and I would have liked to have seen it in Senate Bill 838 originally, but certainly wasn't willing to hold the bill up over a smaller piece to a much larger, much more historic bill. So I really do thank you for hearing this bill at this late hour of the session, and I urge your consideration and support for it.
Thank you, Representative. And I see that Senator Nelson is in the audience, too. Did you wish to come forward and testify on this?
Yes. Thank you, Chair. My name is David Nelson, State Senator from District 29. I was the chief sponsor of Senate Bill 1072 in the last session. And I think what the representative just indicated to you is pretty much how it was. I mean, it was fully vetted. We had all the groups, environmental groups, industry groups. We had the agencies together. It was probably the most difficult thing that we went through was how to get to this definition. The history of all this is, you know, I'm trying to look at how are we going to create the healthy forest. And that was really the purpose of the definition, how are you going to create the healthy forest. And not everybody was happy with the bill, with the definition. That's why we're here, I guess, now looking at it again. But if you look at, you know, where we are with funding for the state of Oregon, the funding for public services has really paralleled the downturn in the harvest that we have done. If you go back to 1991, that was part of our discussion last time. On an inflation-adjusted basis, our funding for public services, as we go in like that, basically started in 1991. Some people blame Major 5, but I think there's some correlation with what we're doing with our timber. Small county, Wallowa County that I represent, when I first started this business in 1997, they had 3 mills, 640 kids in their schools. Now they're down to 1 mill. Well, now those 3 mills are running 2 or 3 shifts apiece. Now they're down to 1 mill, and they're just running 1 shift. The school population has dropped to a little about 350, maybe to 400. You know, it's just a small school, but that's I find there's no jobs there. So part of this bill was, how do we get to a definition where we actually get back in, improve the health of the forest, create some economic development within our communities and, you know, do the right thing. And this was the definition we came up with, and so I'm, you know, I'm very supportive. Of course, I have some biases because I was part of that bill. But I really think it was well vetted, and I would like to see it continue on. And I think the point that the Representative Edwards made was absolutely on target. The certainty that people have when they're talking about definitions is just absolutely crucial. We just can't go on changing that, you know, just because, well, somebody doesn't really particularly like it. And going back to what one of my early statements, both parties were not really comfortable with the definition as we ended up. But working with the Department of Forestry, and as he indicated, the vote of the legislature in the last session, people came out and said this actually was a very good definition. So I appreciate your consideration and would hope that you would keep that definition under 1072.
Okay, thank you very much, Senator. Any questions for either of the legislators? Okay, thank you. We do have floor session coming up in 5 minutes, and we've got quite a list of people, so I'm going to limit you to 2 minutes as we did on the previous bill, and I'll call David Moorman, Bill Cluding, and Jeff Bissonnette.
Chair Rosenbaum, members of the committee, my name is David Moorman. I'm the director of the Forest Resources Planning Program at the Oregon Department of Forestry.
And I forgot.
The Department of Forestry is very supportive of Senate Bill 838. We also are in the middle of implementing Senate Bill 1072 from the 2005 session. We obviously agree with the intent of 838, but also agree that the intent of HB 3562 is important to ensure consistency of statutory definitions. Our reading of 838 is that there really perhaps isn't actually a definition of biomass in that bill. It talks about an example of what biomass includes and has the phrase including it but not limited to, so it kind of leaves open what that definition might be. Senate Bill 1072 is, we believe, a widely accepted definition of woody biomass, not only in Oregon but nationally. It's very consistent with the national definition. Because a majority of this biomass work needs to be done on federal lands, we think there is an important need for state and federal policies and the definitions to be consistent. Our understanding is the Department of Energy, through the hearing process on 838, did go to great lengths to make it clear that biomass under the definition of 1072 would qualify as woody biomass under the provisions of Senate Bill 838. So I guess our position is, if you do want to modify the definition, the 1072 definition is the way to go. If not, I think our interpretation going forward is that all biomass as defined under Senate Bill 1072 would qualify under Senate Bill 838. And one last point is, We just learned this last week that the Coquille Tribe is looking at investing in a biomass facility and is right now researching the availability of biomass for that facility. So I think as they're looking at incentives and the renewable portfolio standards, they're going to benefit from having a clear definition of what material would qualify.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
Madam Chair Rosenbaum, Committee for the Record, Bill Cluding, Partners, Industrial Workers, representing thousands of members here in the state of Oregon. And right quickly, I'll just say that what Senator Nelson said and Representative Chris Edwards, we back their statements 150%. Thank you.
That's our kind of testimony.
Way less than 2 minutes. Thank you.
We do that on the House floor.
Please go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jeff Bissonnette, representing the Fair and Clean Energy Coalition, collaboration of a wide variety of organizations, groups, agencies, businesses, looking at clean energy issues and energy policy. I won't be that brief, but I will be pretty brief. And I'm not up here at this point opposing or supporting the bill, because as a coalition we haven't had a conversation about it. But I'd just offer a couple of observations. I was not involved in the creation of Senate Bill 1072. I was quite involved in Senate Bill 838. The biomass language in 838 was actually taken from another renewable energy bill. It's and I am blanking on the number, another a renewable energy bill that's under consideration this session, and so we're kind of trying to make that renewable energy policy consistent, and so that's where that came from. That bill had already passed the House by the time we were in the bill writing stage for 838, and so again, saying that there had been since that had already passed the House by a wide margin, again, I don't remember the score. We thought, well, obviously there's a lot of support for that. Subsequently, in the advocacy for 838, I'll echo the previous speaker's comments. The Department of Energy had, in testimony and on written letter, had indicated that they saw no problem administering 838 with the biomass definition. So I'll just offer those two observations. If you choose to go forward with this bill, I may be back with a more firm policy position on behalf of the coalition. Thanks.
Thank you for your testimony. Any questions? Okay, we have four more witnesses, and I will call all of them. Greg Miller, Paul Phillips, Julie Brandis, and Lynn Cannon.
Lynn's not here. Down to four, just
about. Oh, Lynn. Link. Okay. Great. Then we've got chairs for everybody. Please.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the committee. I'll be very brief. We support House Bill 3562. Greg Miller, Weyerhaeuser Company, Government Affairs Manager. We want to thank Chris Edwards for bringing this conversation forward to the committee. I do think this is a two-step process relative to the definition issue to improve that. We also would be very supportive of some amendments that would be coming forward to look at a study on the 1995 date in terms of when you could qualify for renewable energy for biomass. Oregon is uniquely positioned to take advantage. This is less about harvesting trees, but more about providing renewable energy sources for the RPS as it was passed. So just wanted to say thank you very much for the opportunity, and we support the bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Paul Phillips. I represent CoGen 1 and CoGen 2. CoGen 1 is a Prairie City, that's Grant County. CoGen plant has 15 employees, supports 130, and in Grant County, that's a lot of employees. CoGen 2 is Riddle, Oregon. It, too, has 15 employees and supports 85 total employment in the area. Both are qualified under the Public Utility Regulatory Policy Act of 1978. CoGen 1 has been operating in the state of Oregon since 1985, CoGen 2 since 1986. The purpose of the amendments, and I want to personally thank Chris Edwards for helping me get these drafted up. I don't want to stand in the way of the bill, but the fact is all we're asking for is for the Department of Energy to really look at that 1995 date that was in Senate Bill 838 and whether facilities that predated that should be included. The study would do four things. Consider the economic impact on the communities where facilities are located, impact on jobs in those communities, the economic viability of those facilities that electricity supports. In other words, if they were not economic and couldn't operate, what jobs would be lost? And finally, how the use of the electricity of those pre-95 plants would help in complying with the renewable portfolio standards that we've established. Pretty basic stuff. I don't know of anybody that's really in opposition to it. The more information we would have on these limited facilities that have kept rural Oregon facilities and communities going would be very, very valuable as you go forward into 2008 and for the 2009 session. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for your record, I'm Julie Brandis with Associated Oregon Industries. And when our executive committee looked at the Renewable Portfolio Standard Bill, one of the issues they said needed to be fixed was a priority, was the definition of forest biomass. As you know, the entire Oregon business community has taken a look at this, not only through our organization and through OFIC, but even OBC has been involved with the importance of forest biomass in Oregon. I do have a member who has just invested about $22 million to build a new biomass electricity plant in Lyons, and it will begin operating in August. And it's capable of producing 10 megawatts of reliable electricity. electricity, and that's enough for 5,400 homes. Sorry, let me state that again, 5,400 homes. And the fuel for this plant is 500 truckloads per month of bark from mills and ground-up urban wood otherwise destined for landfills. So this is truly a green use of this what otherwise would have been waste. And using what our interpretation of the 838B definition of woody biomass, most of the electricity generated from this fuel would not qualify as renewable energy. So rather than ignoring, we should be applauding these cutting-edge investments, and we do thank Representative Edwards for bringing this forward. I think it's also important to take a look at why we feel this bill is just a little bit more than cleanup. AOI has had the opportunity in the past to be involved with amicus briefs, friends of the court briefs, when we go to debate what the legislative intent means. And although it's very comforting to have a letter from the Department of Energy explaining that they're going to use a very broad-based definition of forest biomass, 838 has gone out of its way to change two definitions of forest biomass, or to make a change in what has already been on the books. And to us, I'm not a lawyer, and I want to make that very clear, but to us that signifies a change in intent by the legislature. So we think Representative Edwards's bill is a little bit more than cleanup. We think it's very, very important. One final comment, keep in mind that the Energy Trust of Oregon, which is a third-party entity that has been working on renewable power issues for a long time, has gone out of its way to attract forest biomass projects. They did recruit the Lyons plant. That didn't quite work out. And they are utilizing the Rough and Ready plant. Rough and Ready is an Energy Trust investment. So there is clear intent in state policy and through our third-party entity, the Energy Trust, to use forest biomass.
Okay, thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
And that completes our sign-up sheet, so I will close the public hearing on House Bill 3562. And members, we may need to call you back for a brief item of business later in the day. We're waiting for a draft from Legislative Council to come back. So the committee will stand in recess at the call of the chair.